Can we regain them with the magic of technology? Technology, technology. These are great Unicode characters to signify magic. Go back in time. Woo! Next week. We're just working on it now. This is actually the original NTK manifesto, which is buried a long way away. It dates back to 12 years ago now, 1996, when Dave and I had both been sacked from Wired. Well, there's a long story there. We can't go into it right now. He does exist. He did exist, and he still exists. In all of our hearts. So this is the original manifesto, which we wrote very angrily in 1996. And this is the bit I like the best, which is, if it makes you happy, how can it be sad? Since then, of course, we've all gone on to rule the world, but one of the areas of the print magazine that we wanted to keep was a thing called Idea Turbulence Yard. Back in 1996, it was hip and fashionable to mistranslate things from Japanese. And the Idea Turbulence Yard was this thing, feature we were going to have in the printed issue of NTK, where we'd just come out with essentially really dumb, half-thought-up ideas, which at the time wasn't a business model. It was actually just the idea for a part of a magazine. Now, clumsily translating things from Japanese is no longer fashionable. We have to use Chinese now. So this is me feeding Idea Turbulence Yard into Google Translate, which came up with this as I translated about thinking of turbulence code. Yes, I think we've all been there, haven't we? And really what this is in broad characteristics is what I do every time OpenText sort of clumsily reanimates itself, is that I come up on stage with some very, very shady, half-thought-out ideas, which I talk to a lot of the audience here who are very smart, and over the next 2 years, I completely fail to write a book about it. So this is the first one. We first hatched the idea of life hacks here. 2 years later, me and Merlin still on the hook for that from O'Reilly. Still, they're very interested in getting their advance back on that. Living in public, which is the one I did at the 2005 thing, when not accidentally starting major NGOs. Living in public was all about the clash between the private, the secret, and the public, which we now know as YouTube. And this time I'm going to talk about living on the edge of the network. This is because I felt at some point I was going to end up hand waving. And also, I'm not really used to slides. This is a new thing, and I'm never going to do it again. But this is what a slideshow looks like. This is just to remind me, and to remind you have to hit the buttons all the time. That this is a good game you play. You can go back to your businesses. Whenever you're really bored in a presentation, just guess the number of slides until someone puts up a picture of the internet cloud. Okay, that's because inevitably someone's going to go, well, we could use the internet. Here is a picture of the internet. In this case, it's 4. This is the internet. How many fucking times have I seen that picture? Okay, here's a more exciting picture of the internet. But it used to be that you used to use the cloud to describe to people where they were when they were trying to use their modems. And nowadays we use it to try and like really just scare people into thinking that the internet is still relevant in some way. But the best way we use it is when we're saying Web 2.0-ish things like tag or life hack. Actually, rather shamefacedly, I have become a hype. But the main reason we use the word cloud is because that's apparently where we put our data these days. Okay, the big cloud is where our data lives. We've gradually moved off our humble and dumb terminals, and we're now like we're Facebooking, we're Googling, we're live journaling, and so all of that's in the cloud. And you and I, we're on the edge, which is this weird kind of shanty town where we really can't trust our computers to do anything. We have to give it all to Sergey. Okay. Okay, so Now, I kind of disagree with this characterization. I disagree with the idea that the cloud is where we should keep all of this stuff. Because, you see, I'm walking this thin line here between going for the jokes and actually making a serious point. And I still don't know which part of it is. Okay, so the edge has always traditionally been where innovation happens. Even with Google, even with any of Yahoo, any of these organizations, Dig, they all start on the edge. They all start with someone developing some code, running it on a very basic server. There isn't any idea that they're going to have like a huge server farm of 1,500 machines. They're developing the innovation. Same with new protocols like BitTorrent. There wasn't some big department of over bandwidth utilizing protocols that was developed this. It was worked out on the edge in a basement or in a garage or, you know, on the street, man. And also, do you all know with a stupid network? Has that become one of those phrases or you, yes? Hey, say hands up if you've heard of the stupid network. Hands up if you've used the stupid network. Hands up if you hate the stupid network. The stupid network is David Eisen's characterization. David Eisen was a guy who worked at Eisenberg, who worked at AT&T, and it was his sort of realization of what separated AT&T's network from what was then going to become the internet and how AT&T were going to lose, and he really needed another job fast. The idea here was that the internet was a stupid network. There was really no intelligence at the heart of the network. You just gave it a bit and it conveyed that bit to the other side of the network. And this went against everything that AT&T and telecommunication providers had come up with up until that point, which was to try and make the network smarter and smarter and smarter. The phone network as it stands is an incredibly smart network that works really hard to guarantee voice quality from one end to the other. The problem is because it's so incredibly smart, it can't do anything but deliver telephony. And therefore, it gets completely replaced by a network that's so stupid that it just carries packets that can do voice over IP as easily as it can do Telnet. The edge is also what gives the internet its ability to scale. If you have a really stupid network like that, you don't build it out by going, okay, we're going to have a 5-year plan to introduce the telephone system to Birmingham. Don't know what they're going to do with it, but let's give it them now. What you do is you just add more nodes at the edge. So the reason why the internet managed to reach an exponential speed in the 90s was because it was stupid and because the scaling, the moving came up on the edge. Yeah, I had to put the joke in, didn't I? Okay, so let's move on. So why don't you want things in the cloud? Why don't you want to give your data to the cloud? Well, here's one of the classic ones that I, as in my EFF job, I have to constantly give people a viewpoint on this. This is Google being forced to reveal YouTube's viewing habits. If they aggregate data, if they collect data on everybody, as inevitably they do, if they're the person in the center of the cloud getting all this information and you're sharing your TV and your video not with other people, but with Google primarily, and then Google sort of mediates it out to everyone else, then they have all your viewing habits and they can either sell that or be forced to share it with Viacom. This is another example. This is Six Apart, the selling LiveJournal to Russia's Soup. You're never entirely sure who's getting your data. LiveJournal is now owned by a Russian company, and they're a very nice Russian company, but Russia isn't, you know, up there in the league table of places that you'd necessarily want a jurisdiction over your data to be. So this is the Web 2.0 privacy paradox, right? Which is, say you're on LiveJournal, you're really depressed, because you're on LiveJournal, mood, depressed, and you want to moan, but you only want to moan to a segment of your friends. You want a private moan about your other friend. How do you do that on the modern internet? Well, what you do is you write your moan, say, God, Dave never writes, he never calls, I don't know whether he exists anymore. And you write that down and you want to share it with everybody except for Dave, who is a fictional character. I don't think I've ever confessed that on stage. So we write all of this, but how do we ensure that this is a sort of secret private thing that we just don't want Dave to know about? Well, we give it to a faceless corporation first, right? We give it to LiveJournal, and LiveJournal knows everything about you, but it's in charge of mediating that through your friends, because for those of you who don't use LiveJournal, LiveJournal is one of those social networking things that lets you say, I only will share this with my furry friends and not my fan fiction writing friends. So because, you know. So this is the paradox. In order to preserve some sense of privacy or secrecy on the internet, we hand all our data to the people that can be least trusted to trust this information. This is an old Illuminatus line. Who is the one most trustworthy than all the Buddhas and the sages? And apparently it's Google. Right, you know, we trust Google with our secrets, as well as things that we want to have in public. Now, there are some things that perhaps we should hand over to centralized organizations and systems. There are some things that they do well. And bringing in Google, the reason why Google got to its position is that search is a particularly good example of this, right? It's very hard to think of a way that we could, together of us, all working together, right on, actually develop a search system that was as powerful as Google. And centralized systems do other things very well. They're excellent at building military industrial complexes. Aggregation and commercialization, things about YouTube is it's this big pool of crazy videos, so they can aggregate that so everyone can visit, and they can also make money in a way that if you were just sitting there filming your cat dancing for 24 hours, it would be hard, wouldn't it? They're very good at making trends. Standardization. Large centralized organizations are also very good at standardizing. And this is something that me and Tom Steinberg had a discussion about. Tom, you know, I'm Mr. Crypto Anarchist, and Tom is like Mr. No, government, they're friends, sort of. We can go and speak with them. They're not going to chop your head off. And one of the things I grudgingly agreed with him was Unicode, right? Unicode, standardizing system, needed centralized standardizing authorities. All of these things sort of, you don't think they're going to work, right? Nobody thought the euro was going to work if you're a crypto anarchist, right? Europe's never going to get it together to do a euro. Governments, they can't do anything. They can. They're very good at standardization. Authoritative results, again, Google, very good at this sort of thing. If you want to get an authoritative result, ask a DNS name server, all right? It's like policemen. You can go to a DNS name server, and because it has a root authority, it can give you the definitive result for where an address should be. Whereas, you know, asking a bunch of people here, okay, hands up, anybody who thinks they know the IP address to ntk.net, you know, we'd get some disagreement. And authoritarian results as well. So centralized systems, you know, there's an instinct that we have that decentralized systems are better, but centralized systems do prove good in some contexts. But these are things where centralized systems don't necessarily do all the right things, right? These are things where we've accidentally centralized the internet in ways that there actually should be forms of competition with. One of them is social networking. Brad Fitzpatrick, the person who actually helped develop a LiveJournal, was the founding writer. When he was presenting some of the very first ideas of opening up the social networking structure, we were sort of talking about how this would lead to some sort of competition in the network. And he quoted a phrase, I don't know where he got it from, but this idea that maybe in social networking what we need isn't like 3 or 4 social networking sites. What we need is 6 billion social networking sites, each with 1 member. Right, because then you have the privacy and the control over your data, and what you have is a federation of everybody else. Document sharing. We've seen this already, right? In the previous talk, you know, Google Spreadsheets is an incredibly useful system, but there's nothing about Google Spreadsheets and about Google Documents that requires Google. The two elements that you want is it to be online all or most of the time, and you also want to be able to share it with a subset of people. And Google has no particular monopoly over that position. Same thing with hosting. There's no reason why we trust everything to sort of Blogspot, LiveJournal again, or any of these things. As programs like WordPress have shown, you know, hosting isn't necessarily something that we aggregate in that way and is useful to aggregate, except as an ease of use feature. And a lot of these things have naturally come about after because of ease of use. It's one of the biggest networking effects you can have, right? It's very easy once you're using Google for Gmail and you're using it for you're seeing it every day for you to gradually go, well, you know, I'll just add my friends to it. We'll build up a network, and now it knows about my friends. Well, then that makes sense for me to use it as a way of mediating to my friends. It knows who my friends are, and therefore I don't have to worry about who my friends are. And this is the crazy one, right? Person-to-person communication. Decentralized systems are naturally very good at person-to-person communication because we're just talking to each other. We don't need some central office. We don't need to pass something through a central server or a central system, and yet we do all the time. You know, it was genuinely surprising to me to see Facebooking being how people would say, oh, you know, you should Facebook me. And I'm going, what, you mean write you an email, but on your wall? Is this like super poking you? Am I a zombie here? Tell me. And you know, people do use it. People use Facebook and these systems to communicate with each other, which is fine. It's easy to use. You don't have spammy issues and stuff like that. But it's not the exclusive domain of centralized systems like that, as everything leading up to this is shown on the internet. So, what do we have? Well, we clearly have a problem with privacy. We clearly have data that we're storing in third parties, centralized parties in the cloud, that we don't necessarily want them to have access to. The standard knee-jerk response to that is to use encryption, and there are very good systems. If any of you have not heard about Mozilla's Weave, this is kind of the classic classic model of how to do this, right? They're building systems which will synchronize your bookmarks over all your computers and even share your bookmarks with people that you've chosen, but they're doing it with encryption built in so that the centralized service that you're placing this in trust of, so that it can then distribute this to your friends or your other computers, doesn't actually have access to that data. It can't get to that data without your explicit permission. But it's not just about privacy. A while back, Richard Stallman and a few other people held a summit on the growing problem of what I'm describing here, which is that you have these very centralized servers, and this kind of eats into the free software and the whole GNU contract, where services like Google take advantage of free software, which is fine. It's absolutely their prerogative. But there's this problem here, right, where you can't use some of the freedoms that the Free Software Foundation and the GPL were designed to protect. You can't take the programs and the processes that work on that data and change and tinker them and adapt them to your own needs, because Google has no obligation to give you the changes that it's made or the programs that it's done. Moreover, there's a very strong commercial incentive to keep that data secret, to keep that program secret. So you don't have, for instance, an open source version of Google Documents or Google Spreadsheet, because Google isn't going to hand it to you, even though all of those programs are essentially built on the building bricks of free software. So this is a problem for the Free Software Foundation's general project, the GNU project, but I think it also has an effect if you're in any way signed up to the ideas and the ideals that project represents, which is openness. This is a line from Ivan Prodromou, who some of you may know this week launched Identica, which is an application of some of these ideas to the domain currently filled in Twitter. Twitter is a classic example, right, of the problems of centralization. One is there's this crazy thing, right, where you, in order to distribute your message to all your friends, are having to go to a centralized company in order to give that information, right? And so when that centralized company has problems, either with its business model or its rather strange Ruby on Rails implementation, it's sitting there going, oh, I'm sorry, I can't let you communicate with your friends, I'm really busy, and I've lost all of the data that you originally communicated to your friends, and I can't let you have that, here's a whale. And, you know, we did not join and create the internet to stare at a picture of a whale for 20 minutes, all right? So Evan produced this system, which is basically one of the first applications you'll see coming out where we're trying to move this stuff back to the edge. Most of you will have gone to Identica and just gone, oh, Twitter clone, nice. But it doesn't have my friends on it, so I won't go there. The network effect's already kicking in. But the fascinating thing with Identica is that it's designed to be federated, right? So you can install essentially the Twitter program on your local server, and your version of Twitter will be federated with all the other Identica clones going on. So your messages will be stored on your server, but they will also be shared with these other ones. So we're moving to a decentralized solution. Now, the decentralized solution has certain advantages to giving all your data to Twitter, as is obvious from, you know, their loading problems and the problems of developing a business model when you're just really an intermediary in person-to-person communications. But it's also, so it has a practical solution, but it's driven by this. It's driven by the same ideals of the GPL, which is creating user autonomy. What's the time, by the way? What? Do I have to take a vote on that, or can we go for a definitive source, like the speaking clock? Okay, well, there's somebody coming on to speak after me, so will you shout in like 20? Okay, so how long have I got? What time is it? 26, okay, I'm going to wrap this up. All right, so it's 1984 all over again, but not from this privacy point of view. It's 1984 because Richard Stallman, here depicted, is sitting in his office and he's going, oh God, am I going to have to write an entire GCC compiler, re-implement Emacs, and re-implement Unix just to get to the point where free software begins to compete with commercial alternatives? And this is the situation we find ourselves in now, right? We have Google Documents, we have Google Spreadsheets, we have all of these things in the cloud, and we have no equivalents that you can install locally on your own machine. How do we get into this situation? I'll start slowly speeding up until I'm completely incomprehensible. Well, one of the reasons are listed here, right? We dump stuff in the center, we dump stuff in the cloud, because here in our shanty town of the edge, we have shitty latency. It takes forever to get to our machines. We have terrible uptime. The DSL or the cable modems that you have on the edge just don't compete with the uptime that something like Google has. We have shitty scalability. Anyone will tell you, you can't hang a web server out on a DSL line, because the moment you get slash dotted or the moment you get dug, then you know your DSL connection will vanish and you will have no access to the internet and everyone will be laugh at you, and then you'll wake up in a cold sweat not wearing any trousers at school. But most importantly, you have shitty addressability. If I want you to talk to my laptop because I'm running my little Twitter part of the world on this laptop, you cannot get to it. Well, you cannot get to it because I'm not on the internet, right? Because there isn't any Wi-Fi. But if there was Wi-Fi, imagine it if you can. You wouldn't be able to get to it because it would be behind two NATs. We wouldn't have a DNS address. You just wouldn't be able to say mylaptop@danny.com. So I'm just going to quickly throw out these controversial ideas, and then everybody can argue with me in the pub afterwards. Okay. First of all, here's the first controversy. Latency and uptime aren't as important as you think they are. I've been running my website off my DSL line, and it goes down all the time. This week, it went down because my flatmate thinks it's the router. So when he can't get downloads fast enough, he reboots my machine. And I've spoken to him about this, and it's working its way out. But the thing is that nobody notices, right? Because everybody reads what little I write these days using RSS feeds. And RSS feeds just sit there going, oh, he's not there, I'll ask again in 5 minutes. Oh, it's not there, it's not. It's probably his friends turned off his route. Okay, he's here. All right, so here we go. Also, latency, sure, it sucks, right? If you're trying to get hold of my phone, say, and my phone has got a web server and you have to get through the whole network, the latency sucks to get to my phone if you're accessing data about what I've last tweeted. But frankly, the latency for me is fantastic, right? I really encourage any of you to run a server or a web server on your home network, because the fascinating thing about being able to change things and tweak things and see those instantly replicated on the outside internet, this is the reason we have development machines, right? It's because we can make these changes instantly. So I don't think these two things are actually as important. And I think one of the reasons why is because we haven't thought about the idea of scaling down as well as the idea of scaling up. We talk about like 100%, 99.59s or whatever uptime. But there's also an idea of scaling down, of having things which are slightly more unreliable but easy to access. Things that are running off your phone, things that are running off your laptop, right? Think about how you start off a service. And think of the services that might exist if you didn't have to get a server out in the cloud to begin to offer services to your friends, right? What happens at that early stage, just before you launch out into the real world, right? And also, the edge can scale. In fact, it's the only thing that fucking does scale on the internet, right? As we see with Twitter, as we see with these things, everything else requires a huge expense to cope with the huge inroads of data that they've gathered because they're centralized. I don't need to deal with that data because I'm only talking to my friends, and my friends don't scale either. Okay, really quickly now. Address data reachability are fixable. This is incredibly controversial. Reachability? All right, so... Now, don't, right? Don't. It's always awkward when you put stop laughing and no one actually laughs. It's funny. So IPv6, everybody thinks it's stupid, everybody thinks it's dumb, it's never going to happen. Same with the Euro, same with Unicode. I think IPv6 is not only got a good chance of happening, I think actually it's happening now. If you go to BitTorrent sites, which I never do, and trackers, you'll find that a lot of people are advertising IPv6 numbers. And that's because they're geeks and because they turn on the IPv6 features that are built into Windows Vista. And Windows Vista will automatically route you an IPv6 figure if you ask it hard enough. Same with Apple AirPorts. They'll sit there and they'll tunnel IPv6 if you just flip a switch that says you want to be. With IPv6, you can say, my laptop can say, I'm this IPv6 number and you can reach me. You can pick up the website. Broadband routers as servers, I think, is just a seriously underestimated resource in people selling broadband routers. They've got a node on the network that's not in the NAT. There's all kinds of things that you can run on a broadband router. You can share music, you can play shift your TV, you can do all kinds of things from that point of view. Addressability, death to the tyrannical DNS overlords. DNS, classical idea of centralization, right? ICANN is doing it now. I will promptly have an argument with Lee McGuire in the pub afterwards about whether this is a good idea. Caged mud death fight. But DNS, the one part of the DNS monopoly, right, that's going on here isn't actually that ICANN controls the main DNS root servers. It's that we don't have any other protocols for doing addressability that fit into the URL structure. There's no other way of saying, I can't get a DNS address. Maybe I should use some other way of finding a particular computer. Microsoft, of all the crazy people to be working on this, is doing something in this area called Peer Name Resolution Protocol, which again is a thing that you turn on Windows Vista, and suddenly you have an address on the internet for that computer over IPv6, not necessarily, which identifies you and which people can connect, even if you're behind a NAT. The problem is that there's no way of saying I'd like to go to the peer name resolution protocol on any other machine other than a Windows machine. This is something called the John Gilmore, bless his heart, came up with a solution to this, which is why don't we move everything, all the .coms and the .eus and the .ints and stuff like that, and move them one way down the route and call all of those .com .icann. Right? .int.icann. And we'll say all of those are, it's like Arthur C. Clarke, all you can have everything, ICANN, except for anything that doesn't end in .icann. And everything else would use other experimental protocols, right? So we'd actually be able to broaden out naming to just not just cover DNS. All right, so this is my real conclusions. That other thing was just a fake, right? The edge is the cloud, right? There's a project called the Tahoe project from a company called All My Data, which is basically doing backup storage on everybody's unused hard drives, right? So you have a backup system that works on the edge. And why does it work on the edge? Because we outnumber the clouds, right? Google has this great portrayal of it, like, oh, we have X number of servers and we're much bigger than everyone else. When they're not bigger than the internet, right? They can have 20,000 machines and still in this country, you'll have 3 million, 5 million, 10 million machines that will outnumber there. There's far more power on the edge than there ever will be in the center of the cloud. Normal services will resume as soon as possible. We've always been driven by the edge and will continue to be driven by the edge. I do feel that this is a slight swinging of the pendulum in towards centralization that will now move out to decentralization. And when it does, we'll take the innovation and the clever ideas, the companies like Google and LiveJournal and all of these groups that have grabbed our data and centralized it, and we'll take them and we'll make better systems that will work on the edge. Just as Richard Stallman took the ideas from Unix and then turned a free and open operating system that provided autonomy and freedom to the rest of us. And that's it, I think.
How long have you got? Said you could do either 10 minutes or 10 hours. I'm giving you closer to 10 minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dave Birch. He's the chair of the Digital Money Forum. And not surprisingly, he'll be talking to you about digital money. What time
is it? Should we do questions and answers after this? We'll do questions and answers after this, yeah.
Hi, thanks. Thanks very much. Let me just come around the front to... Okay, so my challenge was to, well, it was when I was invited to come along. Try to explain something about money to geeks and why now's a good time to be thinking about it again. I'll do the why first, and then I'm going to try to illustrate the point by telling you three stories. I thought a narrative approach might... be appropriate, and then finish up with one or two suggestions about the technologies that you might consider. So there are three reasons why you should be unhappy with or the reasons why I think you should be unhappy with money. So first of all, the social cost of money is far too high, and that cost falls disproportionately on people who are poor. So the cost of money, not the cost of the payment system. The cost of cash is about 0.5% of GDP, and that sounds small, but that's actually quite a lot of money. The cost of the payment systems as a whole is much higher. So I didn't have the figures for the UK in front of me, but in say a smaller country like the Netherlands, that means every family pays something in the region of about 300 euros per year in order to have cash. And although you don't care about that particularly, the costs on poor people are much higher. So for example, if I go to the ATM, I need to pay somebody something. So I go to the ATM outside, the ATM says, you know, I put my card in, the ATM says, oh, I'm going to charge you £1.50, whatever it is, or £2 or something. I don't really care, because I'll just get 100 quid instead, because it's a small proportion of the transaction to me. But if you were on benefit and you wanted to draw out £10, then paying £2 is quite a chunk of your transaction. So the social cost of money is too high, and that cost falls disproportionately on the poor. So people who don't have bank accounts have to pay extra to BT to pay their bills, they have to pay to the check cashing guy, and blah, blah, blah. And frankly, you lot have done nothing for them. I'm very proud. I was invited to speak at the very first World Electronic Commerce Conference, and I can report that you've done absolutely bugger all since then. So basically, we still use credit and debit cards, and it's still all run by the banks, and you've achieved nothing, essentially. So basically, that's one thing that bothers me. When you have all this great crypto and stuff, you know, you should be able really to have done something by now. The second point is, by the way, did you know in the UK, sales of postal orders actually went up last year? Postal orders are the most ludicrous, expensive, ridiculous way of moving money from one place to the other. The transaction costs are outrageous, but it's actually gone up. This is because of eBay. This is because of kids buying things on eBay. and they've got no other way to pay but postal orders, which have a transaction charge of whatever, I don't even know, 10%, 15%. You know, it's ridiculous. The second, so the first point is the social costs of money are too high, and those costs fall disproportionately on the poor. The second point is that the transaction costs are too high. So the transaction costs associated with money are too great, and if you can reduce transaction costs, you increase trade. And I'm not going to bother arguing with you about it, but the basis of prosperity is trade. And if you don't like that, go and argue with Voltaire, not me, because in 1724, Voltaire said very accurately on his visit to the UK, trade has made the English people rich, and being rich has made them free. And he was absolutely right. So it, to me, it's important that there's more trade on the net, because that's how we make poor people wealthier, and we make ourselves wealthier at the same time, which is a happy side effect of it. But if transaction costs are high, that reduces the amount of trade going on, and you need to do something about that too. Okay? The third point is that if we want things to change in the future, I'm the sort of person who thinks that competition rather than regulation is the best way forward. And there is not enough competition in money. And if we want things to improve, we've got to start by giving people more choices in the money that they use. So that would be that would be the sort of that would be sort of, yeah, okay, let's go and storm the barricade or something. So right, so that's the do you know, like in 1800, one of the reasons that people don't like government money is because the ability to denominate your own debt is one of the key characteristics of government. Because your debt is denominated in your own currency, inflation means that your own debt reduces. So non-zero inflation is actually good for the government. In 1800, when the government was allowing the pound to inflate, people didn't write stern letters to the Telegraph. They went round and burned down the Bank of England. Look at you now. You should be ashamed of yourselves. So I'm going to tell you three stories that kind of illustrate some points about money, and I hope they're not boring to you. I hope because I really don't want slides and things like that. So, so where should we start? So let's start in the American colonies before the Revolution. So around about 1690 in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So the Americans, or the rebels, as I still call them. So the rebels, they didn't have any money, by which I mean the prevailing economic theorem at that point in the UK was called mercantilism. I mean, this was discredited in the middle of the century. But the essence of mercantilism was the British would not send gold or silver to the colonies because people thought that if you took gold from the UK and sent it to America, then somehow we would be poorer. So they would not ship gold or silver to the colonies. So there was no gold and silver in the American colonies. So the colonists did what people colonizing a new territory, can you see my clumsy metaphor with the internet coming here? I haven't the energy to torture you with it. So the colonists did what people colonizing new territories always did, which is they borrowed from the indigenous population. And if you go down to the British Museum, you can see a fantastic example of this, because what they used was called wampum. And wampum was seashells that were used by the Native Americans for a medium of exchange. And they used to, the little seashells, I can't remember which way around it was. I think the black ones were 10 white ones or the white ones were 10 black ones. I can't remember. But they made these into these beautiful belts they used to carry around. You can see them in the British Museum, which is not far from here, actually. So that's you can do that on the way home if they're not still on strike. So the colonists used wampum. And now a typical contract that would be written in those times would be something like this. So I would say, right, I agree to rent a field from you for £1 in gold payable in a year's time. Okay. Now that was, those are contracts that are written. That's actually a pretty interesting contract, right? Because first of all, none of us had ever seen a pound because we were living in the colonies and there were no pounds in the colonies. Secondly, promising to pay you in gold was meaningless because neither of us had any gold, nor were we likely to have any. And yet everything worked okay. And the reason why everything worked okay is because in a year's time, when my contract fell due, we would commute the payment. So in other words, because we didn't have gold, we would commute the payment into wampum. So the fact that there was no gold didn't really matter as long as we knew what it was worth. Okay? So I would give him £1 worth of seashells. Okay? Now, he would go around collecting these seashells from all of his, there's a problem with that. Seashells, they're okay for the small transactions, but carrying around a big bag of seashells, that gets a bit annoying, right? So seashells weren't very good for saving you. They were good for little transactions, but they weren't very good for saving your money. Fortunately, there was another currency, which was beaver pelts. And beaver pelts, well, you see, the thing is, beaver pelts had a value outside the colonies, whereas wampum didn't. So they had a kind of international value. So the Native Americans were the reserve bankers of the system because they would trade wampum for beaver pelts. So when I collect my big bag of wampum, I come round to your house, I give you the wampum, I get a beaver pelt, and I can do things with that. In particular, I can export it. But I can also sleep on it, which is, it's more comfortable than the bags of wampum. So, and it keeps me warm and all this kind of thing. So why am I telling you that story? Because in that story, if you go to an economist and say, what's money? He will say, well, money really has four functions in an economy. It's a unit of account, a means of exchange, a store of value, and a mechanism for deferred payment. That's economics O-level, if they still have O-levels and that kind of thing. And in that example I've just given you, all four of those had different technological implementations. The unit of account was a pound, the mechanism for deferred payment was gold, the beaver pelt was the store of value, and the means of exchange was wampum. We think everything's one thing at the moment. So we think of the pound as like, in some odd way, doing all of those things. We don't see them as being distinct things because we don't really understand the separate implementations. And actually, as a side effect, as a side issue, I mean, nobody actually understands anything about money anyway, so it doesn't really help. Like, if you tease people by saying, right, so for example, I'll give you a very simple example, just sidetrack, right? So here's a £5 note, right? It's a real one. It's not for a trick or anything. Here's a £5 note. So here's the trick question. Where's the £5, right? So you would say, because you don't know anything about money, you've got the £5 in your hand. And I would say, actually, I've got a piece of paper that's worth 0.001 pence. The note issuing department of the Bank of England is the most profitable nationalised industry in history, with a net income of £1.7 billion last year. This is 0.001p. Where's the £5? Right? And the answer, of course, is you don't know, do you? So. Well, that is not in the Bank of England, interestingly, because ever since 1844, under the Bank of England Act, which extended the Bank of England's outrageous monopoly into Scotland, so when you give them £5 and they give you a piece of paper, they're forced to take the £5 and spend it on Treasury bonds. So basically, the Bank of England buys fixed interest government gilts with the money, and the interest on those gilts are remitted to the Treasury, right? So for the UK last year, that was about £2 billion. So in other words, because you lot are all carrying these around in your pockets, you've essentially made an interest-free loan of about £2 billion to the government. So if this disappeared, the government would naturally cut its cloth to suit the expense. No, of course it wouldn't. They would come around and kick down your door and tax you on something else, but that's not the point. The point is, people don't really think about how the money works. Okay, let's have another story. Shortly after the Norman invasion, I think all good stories in England begin shortly after the Norman invasion. I mean, I feel like we should have a historical context. Shortly after the Norman invasion, there was a really interesting tax problem. You remember the Doomsday Book? So they made a big list of who owned what so you could tax them properly. But the problem is, how did you collect up the loot, right? Because if you're the king, okay, in the old days, and I refer to us in the Wessex Independence Front, referred to as the good old days under King Alfred, you were fighting the Danes, but not terribly far from home. So you would collect the tax or you would commute it into men, and then you go off and fight the Danes. But sort of after the Norman invasion, it all got more complicated because you were collecting taxes in Cornwall and you wanted to do something useful with them, like fighting the Scots, but it's a long way away. So if you rounded up some pigs in Cornwall and had to take them all to Scotland to catapult over the battlements or whatever they did with them, you can see the problem coming in. But there was a brilliant, brilliant solution to this problem. And what they did was they started, so I'm the king, right? So you're the sheriff of, let's say, Nottingham, okay? And so we agree what the tax take is for Nottingham next year, mechanism for deferred payment. So we decide in 1 year's time, you're going to pay me this much tax. And then what we do is we get a little stick of wood and we make some notches in it, which represent how much is to be paid. And then we split the stick in two and you keep half of it and I keep half of it. Those are called tally sticks. And that was a fantastic technological solution to the problem. Right? Because I couldn't alter my half of the tally stick without it showing up when we put the tally sticks back together again. Everyone was illiterate, so the notches worked perfectly for letting people know how much taxes were due. Technology had come to a fantastic solution. In fact, and you can see what would happen with that solution, right? Because what happened was, I've got my half of the tally stick, okay? I'm the king now, okay? I've got my half of the tally stick. I can't wait until next year for the money. That's the nature of kings, I'm afraid. They just don't, right? So I want the cash now, right? So what I do is I sell my half of the tally stick to a merchant just round the corner up on Tower Hill. And the merchant gives me a little bit less, right? But he gives me some money. So I've got a tally stick for a pound. The merchant gives me 19 shillings. Now, of course, to anyone who writes that out on a piece of paper, that's a fixed interest government bond, right? So I'm lending that to you at interest. But of course, that was a bad word in those days. So we fooled God by selling the tally stick at a discount instead of asking for interest. It worked! He never noticed. Now, the point about this, so now I've got a tally stick worth 19 shillings, okay? So I can either keep that and cash it in a year's time, or I can sell it to someone else. So in a very short time, a market sprang up which discounted those sticks in time and in space. So the closer a stick was to redemption, the more value it had, and the closer you were to the point where it was going to be redeemed, the more value it had. So now I'm a merchant in Cornwall, I would naturally value sticks for the taxes in Cornwall higher than the sticks for the taxes in Cumbria. So the market sorted it out. So by about 1190, there was a fully functioning market in government debt just up the road. One of the reasons why those boys are so good at it is because they've been doing it for such a long time. What's the point of that little story? The point about that story is the tally sticks were a store of value, right? So that's what they were for. But because the technology was so good, they became a medium of exchange. So if you're looking for the big arrow, the big pressure, the big driver, what does technology do to money? What technology does is it changes stores of value so that they can become means of exchange. Okay, so second bludgeoning metaphor out of the way. Okay, so that's what happened in that example. Okay, third story. If you were stopped by a traffic... I mean, let's have a real example. This is actually in The Economist, so I'll use their version rather than mine. So you get stopped by a traffic policeman in the Congo, okay? So, I mean, I'm picking the Congo deliberately because the Congo is obviously, you know, a place that has its difficulties. It's pretty much top of the league table, actually, for the most appalling place in the entire world to live. This is a place that's in dire straits. Vodafone has 1 million mobile customers, and they don't even have half the market. So I get stopped by a traffic policeman in Congo, and so you have to give him a bribe, that's a normal thing, but because the social costs of cash are very high, I don't carry any of it with me, the transaction costs associated with it are very high, because to get the cash we would have to drive to a bank, and it's very complicated to get the money out, and blah, blah, blah. So what I do instead is my sister happens to have a mobile phone voucher with her, so she scratches the mobile phone voucher off, and then we text the number to the policeman. And then the policeman can put it in so he gets the credit. So we've used mobile phone minutes instead of dollars as a means of exchange. Why is that important? That's important because if you make something tradable, people will trade it because they're smart, okay? So if you make it easy for people to trade mobile phone minutes, in fact, if you make it easier for people to trade mobile phone minutes than dollars or whatever it is they use in the Congo, then they will do that instead. So the other effect of the technology is it makes it very difficult to control that trading. But you see, to me, that's a good thing, okay? So if you put those things, so if you put those issues together and throw it out as a challenge here, if you're looking for opportunities to do something new, as Etienne said to me earlier on when we were talking about it, you know, people like me, actually, and people like you as well, always overestimate the change in the short term, okay? So we're all very disappointed that we're not all walking around zapping money to each other with our mobile phones, okay? Although I have to break it to you, 500 people in London are, because Barclays, O2 and TfL have just been running a pilot in London with 500 Nokia 6131 phones that have the contactless interfaces in them. So you can use your phone to buy a cup of coffee, to ride on the subway. But of course, what's most interesting about those phones is their cards, right? But they can also read each other. So the technology to make that happen actually is arriving now anyway, even if it's a bit overdue. But the question for geekery is, what's the long-term impact? So if you give me the software and the device and the security, so now I can trade anything, okay? I can trade pounds, that's great, but actually they have no intrinsic advantage over other things. In fact, they have a big disadvantage, which is I'm not in charge of them. I mean, that's disadvantage from my point of view, okay? If I can trade anything, then anything becomes money. And it doesn't matter whether it's commodity derivatives or actual, you know, for one of the things that's going on at the moment is e-gold and gold money and people trading gold that way. But actually, anything becomes money in that environment. And then when anything's money, then you have genuine competition. right? Not between, not that you're making on a per transaction basis, because obviously it would be ludicrous for okay, so here's the car I'm selling you or something. So, would you like some Balinese carvings or this cow I've got around the back or some of those euros, which, and you said they're in the long run, it won't work. So it's a very short-term thing. Okay, it's crazy for us to think like that, but it's not crazy for my phone and your phone to think like that. So if I give my phone the general policy, okay, I want, I'm thinking of going on holiday next year, see if you can find me some euros, some air miles, that kind of thing. I just give my phone the general policy, then when it comes to a transaction, I don't care, I don't get involved. So my phone and your phone, they can sort it out. They're stupid. That's what they do, right? Computers do things that are below the level of the mental transaction cost that I'm prepared to bear, okay? So we haven't got digital money yet. Get working on it, basically. Thank you very much.
So basically, should we take questions? Yes? Okay, all right. So we'll take... I was going to say that all questions that either of us would be asked about this would be so complex and mind-bending that we'd probably have to do them...